Okay, open your Bibles to Acts chapter 3. I'm going to look at verses 1 through 5, Lord willing, this morning, if we get that far. Acts 3 and verse 1. It says, "Now Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour." So this is after the day of Pentecost, and we don't really know exactly how long after, but I assume it was shortly thereafter. And Peter and John go up into the temple. It says they went up there together. And as we looked at back in Acts chapter 2 in verse 46, at that time, the Jerusalem church had been meeting for worship in the temple in Jerusalem. Verse 46 says, "And they, continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart." So this was their meeting place at the time, which 3,000 people would have needed a large meeting place, although a lot of those members probably would have been non-resident members, because the 3,000 that were there on the day of Pentecost were there from every nation under heaven. That's what they said, right? And so I hadn't really thought about this before, but more than likely they... most of them went back home to the all nations that they were from. So I don't know how many resident members living in Jerusalem they had at that time. But yeah, this is actually another good example of non-resident membership that I never really thought about before. So anyway, Peter and John, they go up to the house of God together, and which just reminds us what a blessing it is to be able to go up to the house of God with brethren. And the Bible talks about this in a couple of different places. In Psalm 122 and verse 1 is the first one that comes to mind. It's probably familiar to you. Psalm 122 and verse 1, David said, "I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord." So going to the house of the Lord should be a glad thing, and is something that we do together, right? That's what a church is a congregation of people that assemble together. And when that happens, it's a blessing. And when it doesn't happen, it's a source of sadness. And this is, I think, what is being alluded to here in Psalm 42 in verse 4. Whether or not the psalmist was able to go to the house of God at this time or not, I'm not sure, but this is a song about depression. Psalm 42, 43, there are other ones too, but these are psalms that have definitely a theme of depression to them, and the psalmist here is thinking back on the days that he was able to go to the house of the Lord and what a blessing it was, and either he can't do that now, or he's just thinking back on the good times and wondering why it's not like it used to be. And he says there in verse 4, "When I remember these things, I pour out my soul in me, for I had gone with the multitude. I went with them to the house of God with the voice of joy and praise, with a multitude that kept holy day. Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquieted in me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him for the help of his countenance." So as he thinks back what a blessing it was that he was able to go to the house of the Lord with the multitude, with a voice of joy and praise, and now he's severely depressed. And I can certainly identify with that thought. I've been there many times. And then getting back to Acts chapter 3 in verse 1, it says there that they went up together to the temple at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour. Now in Jewish time, or at least in time that the Bible used, I don't know if this was specific to the Jews or the Romans, but in general in the Bible, when it uses this terminology of the ninth hour, the sixth hour, so on, it is referring to the hour counted from dawn, from daylight, basically, from 6 o'clock in the morning approximately. So the ninth hour in Jewish time, or in the Bible anyway, would be 3 p.m. So 9 hours from 6 o'clock in the morning. And so it apparently was an established custom to pray at the ninth hour. And it appears that it was possibly even an established custom among people that weren't even Jews, because we see that Cornelius was praying about the ninth hour, he said, when the angel came to him and told him that he was to send to Joppa for a man named Peter to come and tell him what he needed to do. Acts chapter 10 and verse 30. Remember, Cornelius was not a Jew. He was a Gentile. He was the first Gentile convert. But he was a devout man. He prayed to God always, it says there in the beginning of Acts chapter 10. And in verse 30, "And Cornelius said, 4 days ago I was fasting until this hour, and about the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright clothing." Now, it could have just been coincidental. He could have just been praying, and it just happened to be the ninth hour and when the angel came to him. Or he could have been specifically praying at the ninth hour because he lived in and among the Jews, and that was an established custom to pray there at 3 p.m. This would most likely have been considered the evening prayer. And I will link together a bunch of verses here, which I think makes the case pretty well that this would have been the evening prayer, which coincided with the evening sacrifice. At the evening sacrifice, there was also the evening prayer, and this would have been at the ninth hour at 3 p.m. So let's look at a number of verses here. First of all, Exodus 29, 39. Exodus 29 and verse 39. I'll just back up to verse 38. "Now this is that which thou shalt offer upon the altar, two lambs of the first year, day by day, continually. The one lamb thou shalt offer in the morning, and the other lamb thou shalt offer at even." Okay, so this is what was called the daily sacrifice in of the Jews. And so every day, 7 days a week, they would offer a lamb in the morning, they'd offer a lamb in the evening. And this happened without ceasing until the temple was destroyed. And we read about that in the book of Daniel. Actually, a lot of people think it's talking about the end of time. It's not talking about the end of time. It's talking about 70 AD. And in the last chapter of Daniel, it talks about till when the daily sacrifice would have ceased because they were under siege and there's probably no more lambs to sacrifice. And then eventually the daily sacrifice ended for a long time until forever, actually. It would have also, of course, ended when the Babylonians took them over as well. But yeah, the daily sacrifice pretty much, yeah, it ended in 70 AD, God showing that that system was forever done, abolished. It was legally abolished when Christ died on the cross, and it was practically abolished when the Romans razed the temple. That's razed as in taking it right down to the ground. But for a long time, for hundreds of years, morning and evening, sacrifices were made. And with those sacrifices was also a time of prayer. And we can see this from several verses, the first of which is 1 Kings 18 and verse 36. This was when Elijah had the showdown with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And it says there in verse 36, 1 Kings 18:36, "And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word." And then he continues on. But this is a prayer, and this is a prayer made at the evening, at the time of the evening sacrifice. So this was a custom that, along with the evening sacrifice, was a time of prayer. And we see the same thing in the book of Daniel, in Daniel 9 and verse 21. Daniel 9, 21. says, Daniel writes and he says, yea, whiles I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. Oblation is a sacrifice. So Daniel's praying at the time of the evening sacrifice, and the angel comes to him. Same thing with Cornelius, praying at the time of the evening sacrifice, there the ninth hour of the day, and the angel comes to him. Now, whether or not, if Daniel is just referring to the time of the evening oblation as that time of day, because the oblation would have been, if it was happening at all, it would have been happening in Israel, but since there was no temple, it probably wasn't happening at all, because this is during the captivity that this is written, and Jerusalem had not yet been rebuilt. But so he's probably, I'm guessing, referring to the time that the evening oblation would normally be happening at the ninth hour or 3 p.m. Now let's look at Luke 1 and verse 10. It's just a bit of Bible trivia, basically, just learning some things about the Old Testament and the religion of the Jews, how things used to be done in those days. Luke 1 and verse 10, and the whole multitude of the people were praying without at the time of incense. Now, the time of incense was the time of the evening sacrifice. The sacrifice was offered with incense, and you can see this from Psalm 141 and verse 2, which I found after I put the outline together. Psalm 141 and verse 2, this really ties it all together. I was really glad that I found this verse. Psalm 141 and verse 2 says, let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense. So in the Bible, prayer is likened unto incense, and I'll show you a verse in Revelation here in just a minute showing you that. But he says, let my prayer be set forth as incense, set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. So my prayer is as incense, and the lifting up of my hands, which is another way of saying prayer, my prayer is as the evening sacrifice. So you see that incense and the evening sacrifice are equated here because they happen at the same time. There would have been the sacrifice, and incense was also offered. And at the same time, prayer was made. And as I mentioned that prayer is likened unto incense, we see that in Revelation 8 and verse 3. Revelation 8 and verse 3. It says, and another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. So here, the prayers are symbolically like incense. Incense, the smoke rises up, and our prayers rise up to God. And so they're likened unto incense, a sweet smell in God's ear, God's nose, pardon me. Now, the Jews had a custom to pray three times a day. They would pray morning, noon, and evening. But actually, I should put it in the right order. They prayed evening, morning, and noon. And you think, well, that's out of order. Not if you were living according to God's timeline, because in God's mind, the day starts at evening, right? Evening and morning were the first day, and the second day, and the third day, and so on, in Genesis chapter 1. Days, according to God, start at dusk. They start at nightfall. That's why the Jewish Sabbath, for instance, starts on Friday night at sundown, and it ends Saturday night at sundown, because Saturday actually starts on Friday night, and it ends Saturday night. And so the Jews would pray these three times a day. And it's actually put in this order in Psalm 55 and verse 17. Psalm 55 and verse 17. This is evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. So this would be the correct order: evening, morning, noon. And this is a good practice to have, to pray three times or more times a day. But an easy way to pray three times a day, every one of us should be doing that before meals, right? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, morning, noon, and evening. So at a minimum, you should be doing that. You should be praying more often than that. It just depends, I guess, on how extensive your mealtime prayers are. I know our prayers at mealtime at home are a lot more than just about the meal. They're about all kinds of things. So I take that opportunity to pray about many things. Now let's look at Daniel 6 and verse 10. Daniel 6 and verse 10. But you definitely want to have private time in prayer just between you and God, so don't let mealtime be your only prayers. Daniel 6 and verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, this is when the other presidents tried to set him up. They were trying to destroy him because they couldn't find anything wrong that he'd done in the kingdom, so they needed to come up with a religious reason to persecute him. And so they had the king sign this decree that nobody could make a petition to any god or man save the king for 30 days. And because they knew that Daniel was a man of prayer, they'd obviously seen him praying regularly, and so they created this mischief by a law to try to get him persecuted, executed, and it didn't work. It says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. So the point that I wanted right now from this is that he did so three times a day, because that's what the Jews did: evening, morning, and noon. And as I mentioned many times, this verse has such a good principle in it that people passed a law, said you can't exercise your religion, and guess what? Daniel did it anyway, just like he did before. He didn't change it. He did it just like he did before. That's what we did when COVID happened and our wicked government shut things down and tried to close down churches. We just continued worshiping just like we were before. Same time, same place, same people, same manner. Or not same place, because we couldn't meet here. But it wasn't because the government told us we couldn't meet here. It's because this is private property and the owners of the property said you can't meet here. That's a different story. The owners of the property can tell us to go beat feet anytime, right? If they tell us you can't meet here anymore, we don't meet here anymore because it's private property, right? If the government says we can't meet here anymore, that's a different story. That's when we say, no, I don't care what you say, we're going to continue to meet. And Daniel's a perfect example of this. And let me give you one more example just to show that of the different times that prayer was wont to be made in Acts chapter 10 and verse 9. Acts 10 and verse 9. On the morrow, as they went on their journey and drew nigh unto the city, Peter went up upon the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. So this would have been the noon prayer. So you have sixth hour, ninth hour. I think I searched, if I remember right, and I don't think I could find where it was specifically said that they prayed at the third hour, but that would be the morning prayer. And then one more example probably the most important example of prayer being made at the ninth hour was when our Lord Jesus Christ made his impassioned prayer to God when he hung on the cross at the ninth hour. And this was in Matthew 27 and verse 46. Matthew 27 and verse 46. Now, I am certain that this was not a coincidence. It just didn't happen to be that Jesus just uttered this prayer at 3 p.m. just because. This prayer was uttered at 3 p.m. at the ninth hour at the time of the evening sacrifice for a purpose, because Jesus is our sacrifice. He was being sacrificed for us, and this prayer was made at that exact time for that reason. No doubt about it. Matthew 27 and verse 46. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And that was a fulfillment of scripture, of Psalm 22. It was prophesied that he would utter those very words. Okay, now let's go to Acts 3 and verse 2. Acts 3 and verse 2. So they're going to the temple at the ninth hour, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, for prayer. And then it says, and a certain man lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. So let's look at that first part there. And a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried. And this poor fellow was over 40 years old. He had been lame for 40-some years, basically about my age, a little over 40 years old, early to mid-40s, somewhere in there. I can't even imagine what it would be like to have been lame my entire life up to this point and have people carry me everywhere I went. Just think about that for a minute. But we read about this in Acts 4 and verse 22. And the man was above 40 years old on whom this miracle of healing was showed. And he's referring to the same man there in Acts chapter 3. We'll get to the miracle of healing later on, not today. But so above 40 years old. And just imagine, like I said, imagine being lame and having to be carried everywhere you went, right? No, I assume no wheelchairs in those days, certainly no motorized wheelchairs that you could operate yourself. If his arms worked or not, but his feet and ankle bones certainly didn't work, we read about. But just imagine what that would have been like. And God used caretakers and friends to take care of this man, and God had done that in previous times also, using caretakers and friends to bless his afflicted children. And we read about that in Mark chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, when these friends of this man took him where Jesus was. Jesus was in this house, and it was so crowded that these men went and climbed up on the roof, took out the roof tiling, and lowered him down to Jesus to be healed. Mark 2, 1 through 5. It says, and again he entered into Capernaum after some days, and it was noised that he was in the house, and straightway many were gathered together, insomuch that there was no room to receive them, no, not so much as about the door. And he preached the word unto them. And they come unto him, bringing one sick of the palsy, which was born of four, carried of four. And when they could not come nigh unto him for the press, they uncovered the roof where he was. And when they had broken it up, they let down the bed wherein the sick of the palsy lay. When Jesus saw their faith, he said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, thy sins be forgiven thee. So this would have been quite the undertaking, just carrying somebody's hard enough. Carrying somebody up on top of a rooftop would have been a lot of work. And then their roofs were obviously built different than ours were. If you ripped up somebody's roof today, you'd destroy it to put a hole in it. But in those days, some kind of easier way, I'm assuming, to take it apart. And anyway, and then they lower him down. And Jesus saw their faith. It wasn't the palsied man's faith, but it was their faith, the faith of his friends, and healed the man. First says his sins are forgiven him, and then people think that he's blaspheming. And then he goes on to heal him physically to show that he had power on earth to forgive sins and to heal. In verses 11 and 12, Jesus said, I say unto thee, arise and take up thy bed and go thy way into thine house. And immediately he arose, took up the bed, and went forth before them all, insomuch that they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, we never saw it on this fashion. Now, it doesn't say this, but I imagine the householder was like, but before you go, please put the roof back together, I imagine. But anyway, but yeah, what an amazing thing. And God used this man's friends. And there's some good friends right there to carry a man around that's lame or palsied. And he used their faith to heal that man. It's quite amazing. Now, this isn't the only man that God had allowed to be born afflicted. This man in Acts chapter 3, that is. He's not the only man that God allowed to be born afflicted and to live for many years before healing him just to show his mighty power. The Lord did this in his own life, in his own ministry, in John chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. This is one of my favorite chapters of the Bible. This chapter proves to me that God has a sense of humor. It's a funny chapter. It's a wonderful chapter, but it's also funny. I'm sure you've read it before. But when the man he's born blind, he's healed, and then the Pharisees come and say, "Hey, how did he heal? How were you healed?" And he's like, "Oh, this man, he made clay and anointed my eyes and washed and I see." And then they ask him again. And he tells them the same thing again. And then they ask his parents. And his parents say, well, he's of age. Ask him. And then they want to ask a third time. He's like, I already told you. He's like, you want to be his disciple too? And so it was just kind of, it was comical how the whole thing played out. And then they cast him out and he makes a wonderful profession. Anyway, but the point is, this man was born blind from his mother's womb. The disciples assumed that he was born that way because of sin, either his sin or his parents' sin. They were trying to figure out who sinned. And Jesus told them plainly that he wasn't born this way because of anybody's sin, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. And it says in there in verse 1, And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Now, some people, unbelievers, might consider this to be an act of cruelty, that God would allow a man to be born blind, to suffer this for a long time. I think he was over 40. Or around 40. I don't remember exactly how old he was, but he was an adult. I don't know. It was a different man that was around 40. But anyway, this man was an adult, so at least 20, right? And he had been like this for many years for the express purpose of years later, after him suffering for many, many years, that the Son of God comes along and heals him and shows his miraculous, almighty power in this man. So sometimes, you know, we don't know why God allows tragedy into our lives. He always has a purpose for it, if nothing else than to make his mighty power known. But sometimes we just have to wait and see what his purpose is, if he ever does tell us. So getting back to this man in Acts chapter 3, so he had people that would carry him, and it said there, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful. So they would take him to the beautiful, what was called the beautiful gate at the temple. And there was one gate that was particularly beautiful. The whole temple was beautiful. And we can see that in Scripture. We're going to look at this one gate here in a minute. But let me just show you a few verses here which show that God's house is beautiful. It was beautiful in those days as a physical specimen. It's beautiful in our day as a spiritual specimen. Turn with me to Psalm 48 and verse 2. Psalm 48 and verse 2. You know, what the Catholics and other religions have done is trying to replicate what was under the Old Testament, that God's place of worship was a physically beautiful place. And so now the Catholics, not now, for the last 1700 years, have built these large, grand cathedrals, these beautiful, ornate places, because they think that that's where God is found, that God is found in this physically beautiful place. Whereas the Bible talks about the beauty of holiness, they consider it the holiness of beauty. They think that beauty is a holy thing, whereas God thinks that holiness is a beautiful thing. And God has not carried this over to the New Testament. Nowhere are we told to build beautiful, ornate buildings to worship God in. It's fine to have a building, but there is no commandment anywhere to deck it with gold and to make it this beautiful, eye-catching thing, because what that ends up doing is attracting a bunch of people that like that kind of thing. They're not there for the truth that's preached. They're not there for the worship that's had. They're there because it's a beautiful place, and it gives them a feeling of reverence. And if you've ever been to a Catholic cathedral, especially some of the big ones, like in Europe, I've been to a few of them, and or even the big ones here in the States, they are very impressive. And you go there and you do have a feeling of awe and reverence when you go in there, and disgust if you understand all the idolatry. But if you leave all that aside, just the magnitude of the building gives you a feeling of reverence. And that's what attracts a lot of people to those places. It's the feeling that attracts them. It's not the truth that's preached there, because there is none. Or very little. Anyway, let's look at Psalm 48 and verse 1. We'll just do 1 and 2. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. So it says there that Mount Zion is beautiful, the city of the great king. And so there's a dual meaning there. Of course, Zion refers to the place where Jerusalem, the mountain where Jerusalem was, and Jerusalem was a beautiful city, and the temple was a beautiful place in that city. But this also points us to something spiritual, to Mount Zion, the spiritual house of God. In Psalm 50 and verse 2, it says, "Out of Zion the perfection of beauty hath shined." So again, Zion is a beautiful place. And if we compare that with what the New Testament says in Hebrews chapter 12, we'll see here that this is really referring to the beauty of God's house, which is his church, the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. Hebrews 12 and verses 22 and 23 says, "But ye are coming to Mount Zion," just like we're reading about in the Psalms there. "You're coming to Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God," just like he was talking about there in Psalm 48, "the heavenly Jerusalem." See, they weren't come to physical Jerusalem. They were come to the heavenly Jerusalem, "and to an innumerable company of angels, and to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and the spirits of just men made perfect." In other words, when these Hebrews were worshiping Jesus Christ in the church, in their church on earth, they were also come to the heavenly Zion. There's a connection there between the church on earth and all of God's elect, some of which who are now in heaven worshiping him. We have a spiritual connection with them when we worship God here. Someday we'll all worship God together. The whole general assembly and church of the firstborn. At the second coming we'll do that, and it'll be a glorious day. Now the temple itself, the physical old temple, was a beautiful building as well. And we have a statement regarding that in Isaiah 64 and verse 11. Isaiah 64, 11. This would have been the first temple before the Babylonians destroyed it. about almost 500 years before Jesus came. Isaiah 64 and verse 11. It says, "Our holy and beautiful house, where our fathers praised thee, is burned up with fire, and all our pleasant things are laid waste." So at this point, the house has been destroyed. The Babylonians have already ransacked it and burned it down. But it was a beautiful house. And then once they rebuilt the temple, it didn't have its former glory. They talked about that in the book of Ezra, I believe it was. When it was first built, there were some old men there, and they would have been quite old because it had been 70 years, and they were old enough to have remembered the former temple. So we're probably talking people that were 80s at least. You know, maybe they could have remembered it if they were little kids, but more than likely you're talking about people that are 80s, maybe even 90s or something, you know, people that are getting up there in age that could remember well the Old Testament temple. But the second temple didn't have the glory of the first, but then King Herod beautified the second temple, and I don't remember exactly what year that was, and it took quite some time. I think when they said to Jesus that the temple was 40 and 6 years in building, I think they were talking about Herod's beautification of it, if I'm not mistaken, but don't hold me to that. But anyway, the point is Herod really beautified it and made it quite a grand place. And it was beautiful. And there was one gate of the temple, so there was like a wall around the whole temple complex, and there were gates to allow you into the temple complex. And there was one gate there that was especially beautiful. And that's why it became known as the Beautiful Gate, because of its exceeding beauty. And I'm going to read to you here from Adam Clark's commentary. He was one of the old Bible commentators. And this is interesting. You can take it with a grain of salt, and you'll see why at the end of the quote, you definitely want to take it with a grain of salt. But it's interesting nonetheless. Here's what he said. He's commenting on this verse. He said, "There are different opinions concerning this gate. Josephus was the most famous Jewish historian and had given an extensive history of Israel in his The Complete Works of Josephus, which I have at home. Haven't read much of it, honestly, but he had two different histories, the Wars of the Jews and I forget the Antiquity of the Jews, where he goes way back, you know, to the earliest Jewish history and then goes the whole way up through 70 AD, which he was a personal witness of. But anyway, Josephus observes that the temple had 9 gates, which were on every side covered with gold and silver. But there was one gate which was without the holy house and was of Corinthian brass and greatly excelled those which were only covered with gold and silver. The magnitudes of the other gates were equal one to another, but that of the Corinthian gate, which was opened on the east, over against the gate of the holy house itself, was much larger. For its height was 50 cubits. That's 75 feet tall. That's a massive gate, 75 feet tall. You're talking about a huge, huge gate. And its doors were 40 cubits. That's 60 feet tall. Have you ever seen a 60-foot door? I haven't either. Right. 60 feet. I mean, imagine the size of that gate. And it's made of Corinthian brass and gold and silver. And it would have been an absolutely amazing specimen to behold. And it was adorned after a most costly manner, as having much richer and thicker plates of silver and gold upon them than upon the other. This last was probably the gate which is here called Beautiful, because it was on the outside of the temple, to which there was an easy access, and because it was evidently the most costly according to the account in Josephus. But it must be granted that the text of Josephus is by no means clear. So that's why I said take it with a grain of salt, because, you know, he says it's not clear. So anyway, what we do know is it was a beautiful gate. It was quite the thing to behold. And then last part of Acts 3 in verse 2 there. It says this man that they carried and laid at the beautiful gate. It says to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. Now, back in those days, those that were afflicted had no choice but to beg. You didn't have welfare programs and all that kind of stuff and government to take care of you. You pretty much had family to take care of you, and if you didn't have family to take care of you or they couldn't do it, you begged. That was pretty much your option. And if today our two choices were either to work or to beg, there'd be a heck of a lot more people working today if you didn't have government checks sent out. But things were different in those days. This man, it wasn't because he couldn't work, it was because he couldn't, obviously. He couldn't walk. And if you couldn't walk, you couldn't do much work in those days. There was no jobs where you're sitting behind a desk at a computer or something like that. You were pretty much had to be out and about on your feet if you were going to be doing much of any work at all. Anyway, John 9 and verse 8. This is the man that was blind from his mother's womb that Jesus healed. And it says, and the neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him that was blind, said, is not this he that sat and begged? So, just like the man at the temple, this blind man was a beggar, and the man at the temple did likewise. He was put there at the gate of the temple to ask an alms. And an alms are charitable relief of the poor, charity, originally and especially as a religious duty or good work. It's construed with do, make, or work, like do alms, make alms, work alms. Afterwards applied especially to the material substance of the relief and construed with give, bestow, etc. So, and this is how it's being used here, that the man was looking for an alms, he was looking for the gift of the alms money, in other words. And I just wanted to define beg for you because it was mentioned there in John 9, 8. This is what this man was doing, although it doesn't say that he, in this verse, that he was begging. And I found this interesting. This is the primary definition of beg, which I would not have suspected at all. It is to ask alms or by way of alms. It's to ask money, bread, money, etc., in alms or as a charitable gift to procure one's living by begging. I would have thought that primarily it just meant to ask for something, but it actually means to ask for an alms, not just begging somebody to do something for you or something like that. Now, Christians are known, or at least should be known, as generous people, and therefore it would make sense that if you were going to be asking for alms, if you're going to be asking for help, you would go to the place where there are generous people, and that would be to the gate of the temple. And Jewish people were commanded to help the poor as well. So this would have been a good place to go. A lot better place than a busy intersection in a major city, which is where a lot of people go to beg for alms today, which is just not conducive. There's a lot of traffic there, but if you're somebody like me, typically before I help somebody out, I want to ask them questions, understand their situation, see, does this person actually need alms or why are they in this situation? Well, you can't do that at a red light, right? So it just depends. Sometimes you can just tell, you can see somebody's face. You can see it on their face and sometimes give them money at a red light. But other times, if you have doubt, you know, we're supposed to guide our affairs with discretion, so I definitely like to talk to people and find out what's going on. But anyway, yeah, Christians are supposed to be generous people. Look at Galatians 2 and verse 10. And this is why, to this day, a lot of times people that sometimes that are genuinely in need and sometimes who just want something from somebody else, where do they go? To church, right? They go to churches because they suspect that people there are generous people. And many times they are. Galatians 2 and verse 10, this is when Paul first met up with the other apostles and he was sent to the Gentiles. They were sent to the circumcision and they're parting words to him were, their parting concern, was that he'd remember the poor. Galatians 2 and verse 10, only they would that we should remember the poor, the same which I was also forward to do. So this was an important thing to them, and it should be to us too, to remember the poor, people that are genuinely, truly poor. I'm not talking about people that don't have big screen TVs and nice cars and smartphones and laptops and whatever else. I'm talking about people that are actually genuinely poor, that are lacking the basic necessities of life. Romans 12 and verse 13. Romans 12 and verse 13. Distributing to the necessity of saints given to hospitality. So this is commandments to Christians. We ought to be distributing to the necessity. Start with saints first and then work your way out. Saints and family and then people in your community and people on the other side of the world are lower down on the totem pole. And by the way, if you are looking to be charitable, I told you about Donor C before. Donor C is no more after the founder of it got brutally murdered here a few years ago in his sleep. It's a horrible thing. Anyway, it lasted for a while, but it's no longer. But there's another thing you might want to check out. I think this is really cool. I really like it. I found it just by happenstance, but it's called Kiva, K-I-V-A, kiva.com. And what they do is they make loans. It's mostly to poor people in third world countries, although there are Americans on there too. That's how I first found out about it. Some lady in Kearney, the stupid county government shut her down. She was trying to make pancakes in her own driveway and sell them, and they shut her down for not having a food license or something. So she wanted to get like a food truck type of thing to make pancakes, and I saw this thing on social media, and then I went and clicked on the link, and it was this Kiva. She was using Kiva to fundraise for it, and I thought, oh, that's pretty neat. So anyway, then once I got on Kiva, and then I realized what it was, they have people, like I said, mostly in third world countries that are trying to start businesses, like little stores, or it could be anything. But anyway, they will apply to Kiva, and I don't know how this all works exactly on the back end, but they apply to Kiva, and then Kiva puts them on their site, and you can loan money to them. This is no interest. These are zero interest loans. I look at it more as just charity. I don't look at it as a loan that I'm ever going to get back, because the cool thing about it is what you do is you loan somebody money, and it's crowdfunding, so everybody chips in whatever, and when they get fully funded, then the person gets the money given to them. They go and start their business, or they buy equipment, or they buy, you know, stock for their store or whatever, and then they start repaying the loan, and it gets paid back to each person that gave the loan, so you just get a little bit at a time. And then the money builds back up in your Kiva account, and then you can reloan out that money. So, like, I don't ever plan to take the money out. I just keep putting a little more in there every so often when I see somebody. And then as the money gets put back in, then you just go back and you can loan that same money. Maybe you have another, you know, you got $50 repaid or something, and you can go loan that money out to somebody else. And then they start paying it back, and you get money back, and then you just loan that out to somebody else. And it's I like it. I think it's cool. I'm not a proponent of loaning money in general, but I think in this case, I like the idea of it. It's no interest, and some of the loans won't be paid back, obviously. That's just how it's going to work. But it's like Jesus said, to lend hoping for nothing again. So when you lend money on there, whatever. You don't get paid back, it doesn't matter, because that's not the point. So anyway, if you're looking for something charitable to do, I think Kiva's a cool place to do it. Okay, anyway, Proverbs 29 and verse 7. Proverbs 29 and verse 7. Now, just so you know, Kiva are a bunch of lefties, for sure. I mean, they're definitely on the left, and I don't like their politics. I like what they're doing, though. And like I've said before, just because I don't like somebody's politics doesn't matter. I like what they're doing. They're doing a good service. And so I don't mind supporting them either, because life doesn't always have to be about politics. Proverbs 29 and verse 7. The righteous considereth the cause of the poor, but the wicked regardeth not to know it. So righteous people consider the cause of the poor. Now, they don't necessarily give to every person out there claiming to be poor and wanting money, but the righteous at least consider the cause of the poor. But the wicked, they're like, oh, I didn't see that. I didn't see that. Don't tell me about it, because then I'll feel bad. I have a quote from Matthew Henry. It must be later on in the outline, so we'll get there in a minute. All right, Acts 3 and verse 3. So the man's laid there at the gate of the temple. He's asking for an alms. Acts 3 and verse 3, it says, who seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple asked an alms. So this man was humble, because it's humiliating to beg. At least it should be. I mean, some people don't seem to have any problem with it. Some people have no problem asking for money. But I've never done it before, but I can imagine asking somebody for money would be, for me anyway, it would be extremely humiliating, like a fate worse than death. It would be an absolutely horrible thing. I'm not saying I never do it. I mean, you know, if come down to it and whatever, I was crippled and disabled and had no other means or whatever, you know, that, not saying I wouldn't, but boy, I wouldn't want to. And it's, I think this is a natural human tendency. This man here that Jesus told the parable about, the man that had wasted his master's money. He was the steward, and the master was going to fire him from being a steward. And here's what the steward had to say in Luke 16 and verse 3. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. To beg I am ashamed. I find it interesting. He's a steward. He's running the guy's house, but he can't dig. I mean, more than likely, I imagine he could dig. He probably should have said, I don't want to dig. I don't like digging. I mean, maybe he really couldn't, but I just find it interesting that the guy has somebody managing his house that cannot operate a shovel. I'm probably not going to have somebody managing my estate that can't operate a shovel, you know, more than likely. I cannot dig, he says. To beg, I am ashamed. At least he admitted it. You know, he's ashamed to beg. He can't dig. So what am I going to do? I'm going to screw my master before I leave here and tell everybody to pay him back a fraction of what you owe him. And then they're going to like me when I'm on the outside, and they're going to be nice to me. And that's what he ended up doing. But anyway, it's a humiliating thing to beg, as if I needed to tell you that. Matthew Henry said, and I thought this was good. I like this. He said, those that need and cannot work must not be ashamed to beg. And really, if you can't work, begging is not a shameful thing. You really have no choice. What else are you going to do? If you literally can't work, now I'm not talking about virtually anybody today, all these people that can't work, right? I mean, you always hear about some, oh, he can't work. Come on. I mean, I don't believe hardly anybody can't work today. You can, there's so many types of jobs that you can do, even as probably a quadriplegic. I mean, there is some place out there that would give you something to do. You could greet people walking into Walmart. I mean, so this, I can't work kind of stuff, I don't buy at all today from most people. But if you literally cannot work, you shouldn't be ashamed to beg, because you have no choice. There's, you know. So there wouldn't be any shame in that. I mean, should a baby be ashamed of himself for asking his mother for milk? Of course not, because the baby can't do anything to feed himself at that age, right? There's no shame in that. Now, if you can work, that's a whole different story. If you're begging when you can work, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Now, it says there in Scripture that God gives grace to the humble and he lifts them up. Let's look at James 4 and verse 6. James 4 and verse 6. James 4:6, but he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. So here's a humble man. He's humbled, right? He's begging when he has no other choice. And God gives grace to the humble. And God, it says that God lifts up the humble in verse 10. James 4:10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. Now this is really interesting because this humble man was about to be lifted up, literally, by God. Acts chapter 3 and verse 7. We'll get to this verse later, probably next week. But Acts 3 and verse 7, it's just an interesting literal fulfillment of what the Lord says when he says to humble yourself and he will lift you up. And he took him by the hand and lifting him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. So this humble man was about to be literally lifted up. He was going to get more than he asked for. He was asking for an alms. He was asking for some money to help him out just for the day. Maybe, you know, for the meal, for that meal that day or whatever. He's asking for something very temporary, and he's about to get a lot more than he asked for. And this should not be surprising, given what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7:7-8. Matthew 7:7-8. Ask and it shall be given unto you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. So Jesus says when you ask, it'll be given. When you seek, you'll find. When you knock, it'll be opened unto you. And then not only does God just simply give you what you ask for, God, in many cases, gives you a lot more than you ask for, or a lot more than you would even have thought to ask for. Ephesians 3 and verse 20. Ephesians 3 and verse 20. And this is what this man was about to experience. Not only was he going to get more than he was looking for, because he's probably expecting a lot of people are going to say no, right? Because that's what happens. You know, a lot of people walk by. Some people give, some people don't. So his expectation is probably for every person that he asks an alms, he's going to receive no. But not only is he going to receive a yes, he's going to get something more than he could have ever even thought to ask for. Look at what Paul says here in Ephesians 3 and verse 20. Now unto him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh in us. God is able. It doesn't say he will do it, right, in all cases. But he's able to do so. And he's able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think. Sometimes God gives us more than we could even think to ask for. All right, two more verses. These are going to go by very quickly. Acts 3 and verse 4. I am going to leave you hanging on this sermon, but I don't want to leave you hanging quite this much. I want to at least get through these two and then leave you hanging on the next one. Acts 3 and verse 4, it says, and Peter, fastening his eyes upon him with John, said, look on us. So Peter makes eye contact with this crippled man, and he focuses his attention on him. It says there he fastened his eyes upon him. To fasten is to make firm or stable, to establish, settle, confirm, to make fast to something else, to attach more or less securely by a tie or bond of any kind. And then in various figurative applications of these different senses, it is to fix something upon a person, etc., to direct feelings, thoughts, attention, etc., intently or keenly towards. And this is what Peter's doing. He is directing his attentions, feelings, thoughts, and attention, feelings, and thoughts toward this man. He's focused on him intently. And here's what Matthew Henry had to say. This is what I was thinking of a minute ago when I told you I was going to give you this quote. He said, Peter, instead of turning his eyes from him, as many do from objects of charity, turned his eyes to him, nay, he fastened his eyes upon him, that his eye might affect his heart with compassion toward him. And Henry nailed human nature very closely, Because how many times do people do it? And ask yourself, how many times have you done it? Have I done it? When you see somebody in need and you turn, you don't meet you don't want to make eye contact with them, because then you know if you make eye contact with them, you're going to feel like you might need to actually help them. So you just turn and don't even look. I'm sure we've all done that more times than we would like to admit to. But Peter, instead of looking away, fastened his eyes upon him. So that, as Henry said, so that his eye might affect his heart with compassion toward him. Now Peter told the man to look at him and John, which suggests that the man was not looking at him. If you tell somebody to look at you, if somebody's staring you in the eye, you don't say, look at me, right? It's because somebody's not looking at you. So the man's not looking at them. He's probably pretty downtrodden. He's probably looking down, just kind of holding his hand out or something. Asked for an alms, and he's looking down. He's, probably ashamed or just downtrodden, and he's just tired of hearing no or whatever, right? So Peter tells him to look at him. And the practical takeaway is, when you want to ensure that someone is going to hear and receive what you're saying, make sure that you are looking him in the eye and that you both have each other's undivided attention. This is very important if it comes to your marriage, your children, your work, colleagues at work or whatever. If you want to communicate something to somebody, you have to make sure you have the person's attention and you're looking him or her in the eye. Because otherwise, later that person's going to say, you never told me that. And they probably literally don't think you told them that because they weren't paying attention, right? And here's one. If you're talking to somebody and he or her is looking at his phone, stop talking. You don't even have to tell them, look at me, just stop talking. And the person, after a little bit, is going to be like, oh, what? I do that. I've done that many, many times. If I'm talking to somebody and he looks at his phone, I just stop talking. And he looks up and says, oh, I'm listening. No, you're not. You're not listening to me. You're looking at your phone. You can't listen to me and look at your phone at the same time. Finish what you're doing, and then I will finish what I'm saying. I will tell you what I'm trying to tell you. I've done that many times to people. Now, if the person is already doing something on his phone and then you go up and try to talk to him, then you're the one being rude. Regardless of what dumb thing he might be doing on his phone, he is doing something and you're the one that's interrupting and not asking him to have your attention, right? So you can't expect to just go up and talk to somebody when they are doing something and expect them to just drop everything and listen to you. Unless it's, your child or something, that's different. But right, if it's an adult, you shouldn't expect that. But yeah, that fries me. I'm talking to somebody and then they're doing something on their phone, they get a text or whatever. Just stop talking. Let them feel uncomfortable. Oh, I'm listening. No, you're not. Put the stupid thing down or finish what you're doing, and then I'll finish telling you what I'm telling you. Can't stand that. All right, one more verse. Acts 3 and verse 5. And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something of them. So the crippled man gives Peter and John his attention. Now, he assumes they're about ready to give him something, but he did not know what was in store for him. He's just probably expecting some piece of money or some piece of food or something. And here's your takeaway from this. Never forget that a blessing from God can be right around the corner when you least expect it. Hear this. The greatest blessing of this man's life is about to take place, and he has no idea. So the next time you think nothing can ever get better, this situation's never going to get better, I'm always going to be dealing with this, you just never know when a blessing from God is right around the corner, unbeknownst to you. So next time we'll pick it up with Acts 3 and verse 6.